You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. You're listening to Sound Poetry, Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM. I'm your host, David Gilmore, and I'm speaking today with Anne Tweedy, who formerly lived in Washington in the Bonnie Lake region not too long ago, helping with the Muckleshoot Indian tribe because she is a lawyer of Indian law rights. Delighted to hear her poetry. I should actually say her name is Tweedy, which should give you the idea that there are many weaves and twills involved in Anne's career and in her life's artistic practices. She writes essays, she writes a great deal of poetry, and I have a book called The Body's Alphabet that was published by the Headmistress Press in 2016. Her chapbooks are various. Perhaps she can just explain a little bit about her early poetry life in the last few years, being a lawyer, graduated from Berkeley University. Tell us about your a little bit about your career, because I think it is so various, Anne.
Sure. So I went to Berkeley for law school, and I had wanted to write poetry for a long time, but kind of did it in fits and starts. And then right as I was starting law school, I really dove into it, which was kind of bad timing in a way, but I've been doing it fairly consistently ever since. So that was in the mid-90s when I went to law school. And then I clerked for a couple of judges in Oregon and Seattle, and then worked for the Swinomish tribe as in-house counsel. So that's up in the Mount Vernon area. And then after that, I worked for a firm also that represented tribes called Kanjin Katsin, and then went into teaching, and I was in a variety of places. So I started with a fellowship in San Diego, and then from there went to Michigan for a year, and then was in Minnesota for a few years, and then came back to Washington to work for Muckleshoot. And then I just left Washington in January, and now I'm in South Dakota at University of South Dakota.
So there's a person on the move for you, Anne Tweedy, a poet, a lawyer, all about the world here. Since I've read some of your poetry, and I know it sounds as though you've lived in mostly rustic places, why don't you start by reading us some of your poetry, putting us in the natural world that you enjoy so much, or wherever you want to take us?
I thought I'd start with The Body's Alphabet and read Interior Architecture and Pale Pink are both kind of about childhood, but Pale Pink's also about our yard when I was a kid, which I loved, even though it was overgrown and all of that. So this is called Interior Architecture. It's almost meaningless to say the house was bulldozed, that house with its pale yellow clapboard exterior, deceptive somehow. White shutters with red shapes, rotting window boxes. It was a place that a child could not invite friends to. It was a prison of artificial walls, the stacks of newspapers, old mail, the boxes of who knows what, the careful stepping of the child through those rooms. The child didn't notice the careful steps, how they became part of her. This is not surprising. This is how learning happens, without noticing. The crowding happens that way too, slowly. It feels worse when someone else sees it, like the man fixing the furnace, looking at the girl, now 10, and she at him, wordlessly. And she imagined pity, but those were her own thoughts talking. What passed between them was clear-eyed, steady, indecipherable. It was decades later that the house was bulldozed by the buyer of the land after the tax foreclosure. There are likely records to prove it, permits and the bills of a contractor filed somewhere. One can even drive by where the house used to be and see a better house, the yard almost filled with its oversized footprint. It's nicer, the father of the little girl says to his grown-up daughter. And the pleasure that tinges his sentence estranges her. But the house is inside the child and the grown-up woman. She sits in the study of her new house in another state and feels the old house in her. Looking out the window at night, the streetlight a few yards off evokes it. The dirt driveway with its long, narrow swath of yard on the other side. She remembers her mother telling her about watching the bulldozer, how the new owner threatened to call the police if she touched her piles of stuff now littering the yard while neighbors sifted. The daughter knows her own stuff was in there too, and that all of this is true. But the house still frames her eyes, those crumbling shutters. Looking out of her window at night, she feels herself within it. She still walks carefully without thinking about it. What is it that loss takes from us?
Well, you carried some of it with you, it seems, in that poem. And it's very interesting to question about the walking so carefully and picking your way along. I enjoyed that very much. It very careful moving through what might be things on the floor, scattered on the floor, right? And so you've got another poem that is also about a similar situation of...
This one is called Pale Pink. The forsythia were not beautiful, but dutiful and stubborn, predictable like little elves, 2 centuries of the driveway that no one trimmed, so that their woody fingers would scrape a car on either side should one venture in. And the small lilacs growing out of pine needle dirt didn't blossom, yet I couldn't help my affection for them. The efforts that don't succeed, the days we just get by, shouldn't we love them? Only the roses in their ballet splendor seemed out of place among that chaotic, undernourished flora. They grew for a few feet along rotting poles and rails. Nobody did anything for them. They weren't particularly healthy or robust, but every year flowers, each with a few tender layers and a tangle of tan pollen-laden anthers. I'd inhale their rich, delicate perfume and think back to the unknown family who owned the house before us. Who knows what possessed them or even what state they left in, but I could close my eyes and almost conjure the yard they must have dreamed of.
So now you are taking us out into the flora and a tangle of flora, unkempt, not taken care of. Very good. So you're leading us down the garden path now. Take us further with another poem.
This one is called Newtson Amplexus.
Yes.
Underwater, the male held the female's neck with his back legs as though sitting on her head. The pair were almost completely still. Every 10 minutes, he rippled his tail and pheromones waved over her. Halfway through, a second male tried to wedge between them, then gave up. But soon a dog running, barking, tromped the pond. In dirt-blurred water, the male unclasped, watched the female rise to the surface.
And your observation of this amphibious creature, the newt, I have met a lot of Americans that have never heard the word newt. And perhaps when I was in other states, they would say salamander as a substitute, but a newt. Tell us about your interest in newts and how you came across them.
I lived up in Mount Vernon when I wrote this, and I don't know if you've heard of the North Cascade Institute, where they have these classes about the natural world. And so there was one on amphibians. I like frogs, so I think that maybe the frogs were the draw there, but it was just a couple days of a class and I really loved it. And then not long after, I did a poetry residence at Vermont Studio Center. I came across this pond in my wanderings. The newts were just fascinating, and so I would like stare at them. I don't know how long at a stretch, but just watch them. And then there was one time when they were mating, and I was really surprised at how long it was taking. Unfortunately, a family came home with their dog, and the dog ran into the water, and that was the end of that. So I really felt for the newts. I don't know what it must have been like to be a newt, but it seemed like they had put a lot of effort in, and it was just evaporated.
And they are multicolored. You don't have a color in there to describe them, but very often they are multicolored.
These were beautiful. I think they had an orange belly and then were dark on the top.
I enjoyed going to ponds like that as a youth, and I really had quite a few trips into fields and concern for the colors of things, the coloration of natural creatures. The poem Blue that you have is one that I think brings in a great number of animals. Have you got that one on hand?
Yes, I was thinking of reading that one.
Good.
So this is Blue in quote marks. If I said bluebirds and stellar jays are not really blue, that blueness is a trick their feathers are engineered to reflect, would this mean anything to you? As if other blueness were a state of being separate from perception, or is it? If feathers look blue, doesn't that make the bird blue or blue enough? Or are we to test blue objectively to make sure it's real? And since birds have been tested and fail, the whole avian kingdom may lay no claim to blue. This raises questions I am not equipped to answer. For example, my Chinese friend who passes as a tribal member isn't Indian because she passes. So maybe birds aren't blue, no matter how they are perceived or perceive each other. Or what about that study on race in Brazil where white identifying people were found to have more African ancestry than black identifying people? So maybe feeling blue is the operative question. But the trouble is, we can ask and ask away, and the birds will never tell us. It's also possible that being blue in Brazil means something different than being blue in the US, or is blueness determined by who's asking the question so that I can foist my conception on birds throughout the world? But if I couldn't base the question on my own conception, then I could only ever answer a fragment of the question, which may be true after all. And if the categorizers were to decide that blue can no longer apply to feathers, wouldn't blue birds and blue jays be forced to change the names they don't know they have, not to mention great blue herons, who don't look blue anyway, except when afternoon lights up their ruffed gray, rendering them too rich and illuminating to settle quietly under the non-color of granite, rainy days, raccoons, squirrels, and ash, all too flat to accommodate the majestic heron who instead was bestowed with the honorary but unachievable blue designation, only to lose it most likely in very short order. And what about Warner Brothers' Roadrunner, who's drawn blue, though real roadrunners are brown streaked in black, save some blue skin near the eye? Could it be that the cartoon Roadrunner, that unpreyable prey, that table-turning phoenix, is the only truly blue bird, the one real McCoy, the post-hawk archetype that all other blue aves unknowingly aspire to as they fly off into their equally unblue skies?
Very, very rich with animal life and dissertation on the color blue. We have a Western bluebird as the Idaho state bird here. And I saw one this summer sitting on a perch outside. And I told my grandkids, I said, look, there's the bluebird. They said, that's not blue. I said, well, it is the bluebird. Wait for a moment. And when it flew off, of course, they saw it with the light coming through as it streaked away. It was a streak of blue,
sky blue as it streaked away. So once the light shone through those feathers, you could see a lot of birds look one color, and then of course you see them in a different light, like starling, for example. That prismatic coloration in their feathers.
Mm-hmm.
They look black. They're a bit of a pest, but what a beautiful bird. See it in a shimmering light, yes.
Yes, yeah. They are. It's almost like that oil sheen that you see in puddles sometimes.
All right. So can we go further into the countryside, or where are you going to take us now?
Beholden, it's a poem about breastfeeding. He exited my body and immediately knew what he wanted to do. One nipple cracked and bled. The other became tender as sunburn. He took hour-long breaks, but it felt constant to me. In the hospital, lactation specialists hovered, offered nipple protectors, hydrogel pads, recommended formula supplements, rest for my damaged breast. I slathered on wool wax, ruined shirts with nipple range, grease spots. Months later, when skin began to heal, his mouth became a strange tickle. Once in those early months, I took a plane cross country and stowed my pump and checked baggage. Before the flight was done, my breasts had become baseballs, ached like they might explode. I remember pained small talk with the taxi driver en route to the hotel, squelching tears during check-in. Somewhere around 6 months, he started to toy with me, pulling and turning one nipple while he sucked the other. At 8 months, he screamed at the ensconcing of the nursing cover. I became a reluctant exhibitionist. Men in restaurants stared. A woman glared unabashedly. Now he's almost three. I unsnap my bra, push him on, and try not to see myself from others' eyes. To some, I'm all body, exactly what I never wanted to be. He strokes my unused breast like a lover, kneads my belly contemplatively. His fingers search out the left side's mole, which he rubs like a rabbit's foot. Sometimes I try to stop him. Others, I wonder if I'll ever be loved this much again.
So that was from some years ago that you have recalled that? Or do you have a very young infant still?
No, That was from some time ago. I have a somewhat more recent poem about my son, but still a little bit ago. It takes me quite some time to revise poems, so that's part of it.
A lot of listeners, I think, will probably be able to empathize with you through this experience, which doesn't last for a short time sometimes. It can go on because of the bonding that goes on there.
I think it's starting to change, but we didn't see too many poems about breastfeeding for a long time. So happy to be part of the change for that. This one is in Rattle, the magazine, and it's called Vanishing Point. So it's when my son was a bit older, but still from some time ago now. When my son was born, his immense need and my ability to answer it were like the two hemispheres of the world. Sometimes I was afraid and bewildered, yet comforted in knowing what my purpose was. When he slept in my bed between bouts of nursing, I'd throw my arm lightly across his chest, like a cave-dwelling woman, making sure that predators had to contend with me first. I remember marveling at his acceptance of my arm on his sleeping form at 6 months, 9 months, a year. His uncomplicated thought was that it was good that I was there. If I turned from one side to the other so my back faced him, he'd wake up crying within seconds. 5 and a half is a different story. Now he throws his 40 pounds around. Until a few weeks ago, to sleep in his own bed, he needed me to read to him, then cuddle him. This often led to my falling asleep for the rest of the night. But now he needs the whole bed to himself. Could I sit on the floor next to the bed and read? I love to put my arm around him and smell the sweet spring air on the top of his head. But if I've eaten garlic or drunk coffee, he says, "Mommy, your breath smells horrible." I've gotten him to change it to, "Your breath doesn't smell that good. Maybe you should brush your teeth, but really it makes very little difference." And sometimes when he has a Lego vision, like a space station or a control tower, only his dad will do. "Daddy knows more about them," he says, "but really our visions are too dissimilar." And he's like Chihuly, wanting minions to execute what's in his head. I think of my grandmother crying when I told her at 5 that I didn't like a doll she'd given me because its lined blue irises stared vacantly. My dismay then was rooted in the thought that adults were supposed to be stronger, less fragile than the sturdy kids who were waiting their turn to rule the earth. But here I am.
Do you read your poems to your son?
No, but sometimes he's come to readings, and I think I do censor myself a little bit when he's there, but, you know, there'll be poems I read that mention him, and I wonder what he'll say, but he hasn't really questioned me about it too much, but I do feel a little bit self-conscious now that he's older, and we'll see these poems about when he was younger and what my thought process was at the time.
Well, you did have a motif about the Indian identity in the blue poem. Do you have some poems that actually bring in your relationships with the Native Americans?
I'll read this one. It's on my website. I can jump over to that and read a poem that has to do with colonialism and what it's like to be a white person concerned about Native issues. So that'll just...
Yes. Good. I think that many need to hear that word colonialism more throughout our history in its internal metaphor, because after all, the whites were colonials in the Indians' eyes, colonial settlers taking over their lands and spaces.
And you can definitely still see that in that's that process. I mean, throughout history, American history, there have been attempts to, we would call it genocidal now, obliterate Native cultures, and that's been ignored, or I don't think people see how harmful that was. At least Congress is on the side of supporting tribal governments, but you'll still see Supreme Court decisions that are very hostile to tribes in some circumstances, particularly if they're trying to regulate non-Indian activities on the reservation. You see a lot of fear and hostility in those, implicit in a lot of those opinions. So I think colonialism is still very much alive, I guess you could say, unfortunately. This one is called Unnatural Selection. A house sparrow roosts in the carport. Haloed suddenly by my flashlight, he blinks his black bead of an eye the way I blink when awakened by lamp glow. The book on birdhouse building advises, trap and eliminate this old world finch who harasses native cavity nesters. Though he doesn't fly, I think I can read fear in his shiny eye. Glyphs of guano on the rafter below score an intention to stay. What birder could lure with winter seeds, houses, suet, only to exterminate? Oh, for a logical heart, for a love that discriminates. His kind, like mine, has colonized not just this tilled valley, but the entire lower 48. It's no human province, is it, to go back to Brooklyn, 1851, and lock those wire cages? We suffer the world as we've made it.
Excellent. Right to the point. Yeah, very good. Even with the depriving of some tribes of their name as a tribe, taking them out of the registry of tribes, what a terrible insult that is to happen. That is a kind of obliteration in itself, is it not?
That's true. So sometimes that's happened where, unfortunately, the standard is quite high to be recognized as a tribe by the federal government. So what it means to be recognized by the federal government is then that the tribe would be entitled to deal with the federal government as another government. And so there'll be grants attached to that. And then the tribe will be entitled to consult, like we saw with the pipeline project that went through the Standing Rock area, because they're recognized as an entity that the federal government has to consult with if their interests are going to be affected. Recognition is very important, and the standard is that for a tribe to be recognized, they have to show that they existed as a political entity going back from contact forward. And so the more oppressive actions that a tribe was subject to, in some sense, the less, and that there are tribes that have been heroically survived and those sorts of actions. But to some extent, I think you can say that the more oppression the tribe was subject to, the less likely they're going to be able to meet this test. And then sometimes we've had tribes put on the list and taken off based on the argument that they didn't really meet the test. And so that's been something that's really hard. And then sometimes tribes can get recognized by Congress. So if Congress chooses to recognize a tribe, then they don't have to go through that administrative process and meet that test. But then they have to have political will on their side. So that's another route.
Yes. Well, I'm sure that you could go on on that subject, because you're the teacher of it. But let's go back to the tribes of natural creatures, maybe, and you can take us a little further into one of the rustic regions that you write about so much, with squirrels and other creatures. But choose one of your own, anyone you wish to read.
Okay, I thought I'd read. This one is a new one called Flagbird, about the redheaded woodpecker. That's one of its nicknames. Mm-hmm. And it's about South Dakota. So I haven't gotten a chance to write too much about South Dakota yet, but this was one. One, walking riverward toward the Missouri, the redheaded woodpecker, Wagnuca, eludes me. Flash of white and black that I first mistook for magpie, though rare in my new state. Two, all through the county, they catch insects along farm fences and in fields, leaving quickly if you approach by bike or foot, a mysterious brightness. Three, but more plentiful among these groves near the river. Out here, you can see their red heads from afar as they land on snags and high up in live trees, even on dead fallen boughs along the banks. Always too fast to get a good picture with my long lens, the modern version of Audubon's long tom. Four, in the old days, the farmers offered bounties for their bodies. Now here on this public land, Army Corps flood control project, these woodpeckers are the masters. The orioles, redstarts, waxwings, warblers have to fend off Wagnuca's theft of eggs and nestlings. Grasshoppers may at any moment find themselves stored in live crevices. The humans have to adjust to the knowledge that they may never get a good picture. Five, Wagnuca, who gave the Lakota the flute so long ago, showing the young hunter how to use a beak-drilled branch and wind to make music. The hunter returned to his people without meat, the elk having gotten away, but happy. Wagnuca, who visits here only to breed, and who, nomadic, may be uncommon next summer, I will try to content myself with glimpses of your gorgeous contrasts. Will practice gratitude that despite the felling of dead trees and creosote and telephone poles that undoes hatching, you've arrived.
That takes us into avian lore again in a way that's much deeper, and I hope that the listeners can take that deeper interest in the natural world from your poetry. That's definitely how you're seducing the reader into those those secret places and the intricate coloration of the animals and the birds. Well, I think that if you'd like to read another poem to close.
Sure. This one is called Early Kitchen, and so it's coming out in the chapbook I mentioned from Last Word Press called A Registry of Survival, which is about my relationship to my mother and her home, a period of time when she was homeless. Early Kitchen, but it includes earlier childhood material as well. Early Kitchen, the floor was tan yellow, chipped linoleum tile. Each year widened, thickened its blanket of newspapers, unread mail. The small gas stove near the sink, irresistible source of heat in a drafty house, more than once drew me to it to burn myself. Bright red curtain framed two small windows and made my mother think of prostitutes. There was a phone my father pulled from the wall that left its cords to dangle, and a night the police banged at the door and the front hall's louvered windows, threatening to break in, while my mother and I stood at the kitchen threshold, holding each other. It's true that the wallpaper's amiable village scenes absorbed countless yelling matches, but sometimes in the early years, we three sat cross-legged on the gritty floor, talking and laughing, eating supper.
Home life from when you childhood. How old were you there?
I was thinking over a period of time, but probably like 4 to 10 in there. It was a house that I lived in until I left for college. But
in your Massachusetts life, is that?
Yeah, grew up in Mansfield, Massachusetts. So.
Yes.
That was that kitchen.
Very fine. We're going to leave you with your kitchen poem as a young girl. And we've been listening to Anne Tweedy reading the poems of her amphibious multi-bias world. Polybias, perhaps, if I wanted to use the Greek for that. Thank you very much, Anne. You have been listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma. I'm your host, David Gilmore, and please listen carefully again if you wish. Twice a day, you can hear Anne Tweedy's poems. Thank you very much, Anne. It was wonderful.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really great to talk with you.